is CoDiscovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. 9,900,000 people fell ill with TB in 2020, according to the World Health Organization, and 1.5 million died. Global efforts to combat the disease have saved an estimated 66 million lives since 2000, but the COVID-19 pandemic hit the fight against TB hard. For the first time in over a decade, TB deaths increased in 2020. The work being done by today's three guests, supported by the EU's Horizon 2020 programme, is more vital than ever. Welcome to Hossam Haik, a dean at the Israel Institute of Technology, the Technikon. Hossam leads activities developing non-invasive smart sensors and wearable devices to enable the early detection of diseases such as TB and lifelong monitoring of health disorders. Hello, Hossam.
Hello, Abigail.
Teresa Cortez is based at the Institute of Biomedicine at Valencia, part of the Spanish National Research Council. She's interested in understanding how the bacteria that causes tuberculosis in humans infect, survive, cause disease, and develop antibiotic resistance. Hi, Teresa.
Hello, Abigail. Hello, everyone.
Iñaki Comas is part of the Tuberculosis Genomics Institute at the Institute of Biomedicine in Valencia in Spain as well. He unravels the intricacies of pathogen genomics to understand the evolution and epidemiology of infectious diseases. His lab is particularly focused on tuberculosis, but also works on other diseases like COVID-19. Hi, Iñaki.
Hello, everyone.
I'll start with Hossam, if I may. Hossam, your project, APATCH, supported by the EU and the Gates Foundation, is demonstrating a novel means of diagnosing tuberculosis using a stick-on patch. Can you tell us what the problems are currently with the way that we diagnose tuberculosis?
In order to understand the main issue with the tuberculosis, we have to understand that the early symptoms of the disease are not specific, and this is by itself complicates the diagnosis. And therefore, most of the existing biodiagnostic tests are usually slow, have low sensitivity and specificity, and or, if you like, accuracy, and many times are too expensive or complex for resource-limited settings. For example, if we take a look on the sputum culture, which costs around 2 to 8 euros per test, and that depends on the country, this technique is insensitive and takes around 4 to 8 weeks and at least 3 visits by the patient to finalize the diagnosis before it starts the treatment per se. The only technology which can provide us a diagnosis within 2 hours is called GeneXpert, but nevertheless, it has relatively limited accuracy or sensitivity. It's around 88% in some cases. In other cases, it's 67%. And in addition, this technology has complicated ways in order to collect the sample and also requires some installation and complicated infrastructure. And therefore, in many times, it's not accessible to settings that has limitations in terms of resources. We have also many other technologies which used for diagnosis of TB, but nevertheless, most of them are complicated and have disadvantages in terms of the way they are collecting the sputum or process the body fluids, or in many times they have some risks in terms of the biosafety.
Okay, I see. So they're either slow or else not as accurate as needed in order to pinpoint a potential outbreak.
Exactly.
Right. And so can you then tell us a little bit more about APATCH? So how does APATCH differ from these methods that you've just been describing?
The APATCH concept actually promotes the uptake of personalized tuberculosis triage and diagnosis for use in clinics and community. And that includes also areas where we have no mobile or internet connectivity. The approach itself relies on a low-cost wearable sensor patch that can be attached to the arm or to the chest to analyze some array of chemical compounds that are associated with the tuberculosis and that exist in the gas phase above the skin itself. The patch itself costs around 1 euro per patch. It's fast, simple, and really easy to use. There is no need for a special training in order to use this patch. And the nice thing about this technology that it can be activated by the smartphone throughout the feature, which call it RFID, which found in every smartphone today, and need no battery, which is also important for green technology as well.
Okay. The benefit from what you're describing, and especially as you've mentioned the fact that it's cheap. I mean, for what it is, it's very cheap, it sounds like. Obviously, then the benefit is that it can be used in environments where people are living on $1 a day and that maybe there's no real infrastructure for them. But then you also mentioned smartphones. So I'm wondering, are those communities carrying smartphones?
Yes, it seems very weird, but according to the recent statistics, more than 77% of the people in the developing countries have mobile phones or smartphones. And of course, when I talk about RFID technology, which read the data from our patch, even regular mobile, which is not a smartphone, can work as well.
Okay, fantastic. So it's accessible to communities who are in the middle of nowhere and living on very, very little.
Exactly.
How does the data then get back to the healthcare professional concerned, supposing the healthcare professional can't make it across to that particular village or whatever?
These smartphones, of course, are connected with the mobile network. And throughout the mobile network, we can provide all of the data directed to the cloud or big data resource from where the results can be accessed to the healthcare systems or for the clinicians.
Okay, great. And of course, that must be happening almost in real time. How long does it take for the patch to recognize the volatile chemicals and for the healthcare professional to know that there might be an outbreak or an issue?
As I have said, the patch will need only 1 to 2 minutes in order to give us the result whether the patient has TB or is healthy. And of course, the nice thing about the patch that it's a hardware that we can train it by machine learning or by artificial intelligence. So if we have other pandemics or other types of disease, we can remotely train the device by feeding the new algorithm into the device. So we can train it in different way. You just need to think about it as a smartphone device where we have the app where every time we use the device, which is the smartphone, in different way according to the app, which is different algorithm.
That's absolutely brilliant. It sounds wonderful. I'm not surprised the Gates Foundation embraced it as well. It does sound like the tool that the clinicians have been waiting for, but it must have been incredibly challenging to develop. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you actually developed this? How long has it taken?
Yeah, of course, to develop this approach, we had first of all to prove the science behind it, namely that there is a profile of unique chemical compounds that are emitted because of the TB or as a result of the TB into the headspace of the skin. And for this phase, we were supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to carry in-depth analysis for thousands of real skin samples of TB and healthy subjects in a wide variety of hospitals worldwide. And the results have shown that indeed the TB has unique molecular fingerprint of volatile organic compounds that appear in the skin and that can be distinguished from other types of disease. Nevertheless, this discovery has been achieved by a lab instrument, which we call it mass spectrometry, which is really very big, heavy instrument, expensive, and also slow. It takes sometimes 2 or 3 hours in order to obtain one result. And therefore, to translate these results from the basic science to the point of care reality, the EU has supported our efforts throughout the Horizon 2020 A-Patch program, where we have developed and characterized these smart patches that can capture and detect the profiles of the chemicals of the TB from the skin in really affordable way, cheap manner. It's around €1 per patch and very fast way. And this patch actually has been achieved throughout the development of an array of ultra-thin sensors and artificial intelligence in a way that imitate the way our skin works. Of course, this journey was not simple as it might sound.
It doesn't sound simple at all. It sounds very, very stimulating and exciting.
We have to develop all the parts of the technology from A to Z, from the material design till the device architecture and to the development of the way how we outreach the information itself. And of course, we had many challenges of reproducibility, repeatability issues, and the most important, which way we have to use in order really to make this technology affordable and accessible to every person, disregarding of where he or she lives and how many fund they do have.
Brilliant.
After, of course, of overcoming all of these challenges, we do have this technology right now in reality, and we have started to use it.
Okay, then that was going to be my question, actually. I was about to ask you, I mean, where are you up to with regards to clinical validation? Is it already being used in the field? How's that going?
These patches actually has been validated in three independent studies right now on 1,000 subjects in India, South Africa, and also Latvia. And we are still working on further examinations. The results so far has shown, based on double-blind analysis, that we can distinguish active tuberculosis from healthy controls with over 90% sensitivity and over 80% specificity. Also, and the nice thing about it, that the patches have shown excellent discrimination between the so-called latent tuberculosis and active tuberculosis with over 90% accuracy, which is very important as well. And these promising results actually today has been used as a launch pad for other infection disease, such as malaria, hepatitis C, and also non-communicable disease such as diabetes and metabolic syndrome. All of these are already being validated and examined in our research group in the Technion.
You must be very proud of your work and the work of your team. How do you feel about the work that you've done?
I'm very proud about my team. They are the real people who is doing the real job, very hard job, which includes also basic science, translational science, and engineering in one lab. And the nice thing about it, and really what makes me happy, that it's really very multidisciplinary research and development. And every team member speaks many scientific languages to communicate this multidisciplinary project with each other.
Oh, that sounds brilliant. What about the other guests here today? So Iñaki, Teresa, do you have any questions that you'd like to put to Hossam? Yes, Teresa.
Yes, so Hossam, I think it's a very interesting work, and it's amazing that we can have just a patch on the skin that can help us identify who has active TB and latent tuberculosis. I was just wondering, what about drug sensitivity and drug profile of the bacteria? Can your patch infer if you are dealing with drug-resistant bacteria or drug-sensitivity bacteria to infer treatment?
Of course, we have started to tailor our device in order to make follow-up of the treatment process for two ways. First of all, because of the multi-resistant bacteria. This is one side. And on the other side, we have started to train our system and to examine it in Latvia today, in order to follow up the treatment process with the hope that we can personalize the treatment according to the right treatment and also the timeline that is needed for the treatment. For example, today there is very well-defined period for the treatment, and we hope sometimes we might shorten or elongate that period, but for that we need something to follow up the treatment in real time, every hour or every day or every week, not every few months as well.
Because of course, each individual, I'm sure, would be responding to the treatment slightly differently. We're not one size fits all. So this way, you'd actually be able to see where, how far the treatment had actually progressed in controlling the bacteria.
Exactly. And this is what I mentioned with personalized TB treatment. So we will personalize it. Namely, we will have the patch on the skin of the person, and that will be the baseline. And then we will start the process of the follow-up based on that baseline. And from that, we can just tailor the treatment accordingly.
Excellent. Wonderful. And also saves a lot of drugs being used unnecessarily and so on. Iñaki, would you have a question? Yes, please.
Yes. So very nice, Hossam. I just have a question, because now we know that latent tuberculosis is not anymore the definition of or one single thing, but it's really a spectrum of states. No? So it's people that we thought before they have a latent tuberculosis, they may be in very different infection status. And this includes this what is called incipient tuberculosis, subclinical tuberculosis, even people that has been able to clear tuberculosis. No? So you had shown that probably your patch can distinguish a latent and active tuberculosis. Do you have any plan to try to adapt it to these different stages? So, because this is becoming a really important topic in tuberculosis.
Actually, we haven't thought about it, but glad you raised this comment, and we'll be glad to find a way to collaborate with you guys.
Perfect. Yes.
I shall put you all in contact with each other at the end of this. No, excellent. Thank you very much indeed, Hossam. That was fascinating. I'm going to move over to Teresa now. Teresa, the MTB TransReg project focused on understanding how TB adapts to stress and drug resistance at the molecular and cellular level. So what was the characteristic of TB infection that most interested you?
So to me, the most interesting aspect of TB infection is, as we were just talking about, the spectrum of TB disease. And we know that some cases develop active disease, but most of the cases go into developing an asymptomatic latent infection that we just talked about it. That is not just a single state, it's a plethora of different states. And we know here the bacteria can remain dormant for decades in the host. And if we take into account that the current estimates are that a quarter of the global population is latent infected, that represents over 2 billion people. So these people have the potential to reactivate the disease and become infectious during their lifetime. So there, we have a huge reservoir of potential reactivation of the disease. And you can start to realize of the magnitude of the problem we face with latent tuberculosis. So for me, it's important to understand that during this process of infection, the bacteria must adapt to a diverse variety of environments. And still today, we don't know the molecular mechanisms that the bacteria uses to switch, for example, between active replication and latent or dormancy inside the host. And in this respect, our previous research has shown that regulatory control at the level of protein synthesis might be important for this process.
Now, can I break you down slightly? Regulatory control at the level of protein synthesis. Could you break that down for me a little bit? What is the bacteria actually doing with the protein that changes?
Well, I mean, protein synthesis at such is a very important process that all cells make proteins, and it's very conserved among proteins. But we have started to realize is that that process that we had thought that it was very conserved and we thought it was very well known has different levels where it can be regulated that vary now, and that can alter how the bacteria is making the protein, if that makes sense.
No, that does. Thank you. That's a good explanation. Okay, so tell us more about the production of the protein in the cells and why it matters. I know it's a technical concept and it might be quite difficult to break it down, but you're doing really well so far. So tell us a little bit more about why is the way that the protein is produced and used important?
So as I said, I mean, protein production is a requirement for all cells for survival and replication, and it involves many cellular components, with about half of the energy expenditure of growing cells being used towards protein synthesis. And protein synthesis is basically the way that messenger RNA or genes are read by the ribosome, which is the machinery that makes protein production possible in order to synthesize proteins. And in bacteria, genes carry canonical signals that are known as the Schindler-Carnot sequences. And those signals tell the ribosome where to start producing proteins from those genes. And they are like a genetic signposts, if you want, that an organism DNA harbors in order to tell a ribosome where to start making proteins. And these kind of sequences are found in genomes from many types of bacteria. However, in the TB bacterium, approximately half of the genes in the genome engage with ribosomes without using these conventional signposts.
And is that something that's relatively recently been understood?
Well, it's true that there are many bacteria and, for example, many archaea that do not rely on those canonical signals to start translation. And that's something we have just started to realize thanks to the use of whole or next-generation sequencing techniques where we can screen the whole transcript. And we do know that it's not something that it's just common to tuberculosis. I mean, many other bacteria from the same, if you want, family also have this characteristic. What is important in the context of tuberculosis is that there are several of these genes that rely on non-canonical signals to produce proteins. They are important during the persistent state of bacteria.
Okay, so break that down for me then. So some of them are not using the signals that are typically used. And what does that tell us with regards to the TB bacteria? What does that tell us? Does it warn us that it's going to go from latent to active, or is there some indication that it changes depending on the status of the condition?
Well, it's telling us a lot of interesting things from the, let's say, fundamental point of biology. I mean, we know that now TB bacteria, tuberculosis, by the fact of not having a lot of genes with a conventional Schindler-Carnot sequence that the ribosome is going to recognize, relies possibly on alternative mechanisms that haven't been described at all in order to be able to initiate translation.
And is that what you're looking at, what the alternative mechanisms are? And if you discover what those alternative mechanisms are, might it be possible to disrupt them and to find, therefore, a new way of treating?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by knowing how the molecular ribosomal machinery or the translation machinery regulates new novel mechanisms for protein production, it has a lot of potential to be able to target this process.
So if you can work out the machinery, you can throw a spanner in the works of that machinery and stop it from working.
Yeah, exactly. And also bear in mind that most of the antibiotics that we currently use to target tuberculosis target the ribosome. They target the ribosome and they associate or they are interacting with parts of the ribosome that are key in the process of translation initiation, for example. So if we do understand how these mechanisms operate, we are going to be able to infer new potential targets for antibiotic treatments.
Fantastic. It sounds wonderful. And I can totally see that by deconstructing, you can almost, you can work out what to target, you can work out what to disable, what to get in the way of, what to interrupt. Great. Super. Does anyone have any questions for Teresa? This is very interesting research. Yes, Jose.
There is a big debate among the specialists in the field of cancer whether there is a need to treat precancerous lesions or not. I would say it's 50-50%. And I would bring the same question to the TB field. There is a need to make a treatment at the very early stages of the TB, at the latent stage, for example. Do you think it's a needed or efficient or helpful, or it's quite risky?
To treat at the latent state, I think it's needed. I mean, I guess that in an ideal world, I think a treatment for targeting the latent state, it will be needed because, as I mentioned at the beginning, the potential of people with latent tuberculosis that at some point are going to develop active tuberculosis and be infectious and actively transmit, it's very high. Iñaki?
No, I just wanted to say it's something that is... has been going on for a while, treating latent tuberculosis, but only in particular risk groups. So you give a kind of isoniazid preventive therapy to these groups. But the reality is that because we have this spectrum, and until now we have treated all people that we consider latent as one single thing, it doesn't work that well because we don't know really who we have to treat or not, who is in risk or not of developing TB, because we don't know how to classify them in the spectrum. Because obviously, as Teresa said, I don't think we can treat one quarter of the world population, which, by the way, is healthy. So you need to ask these people, okay, you are healthy, but anyway, I'm going to give you a drug. No, so I probably we need more evidence for that. No,
yeah, this is what I'm trying to say, that you know, latent is like a healthy person at high risk to get or at medium risk to get TB in the future, and therefore the issue whether to treat or not is really a big issue to think about. But anyways, if there will be a treatment, of course, I think the regulation system will find a way how to use it.
Well, the regulation system and the regulatory system and also Iñaki, because I'm going to turn to Iñaki right now. This is actually really sort of where your project comes in. Through your project, Iñaki, TB Accelerated, you wanted to get a better understanding of the TB genome to develop innovative methodologies to transcribe transmission at an unprecedented resolution. So you were looking at the stages of transmission and I guess also considering the various stages of latency. What were you hoping that whole genome sequencing would reveal?
So we are whole genome sequencing the bacteria, so the pathogen that is infecting TB people, TB cases, sorry. And we use this information from the genome of the bacteria because it's like us. There are not two genomes that are the same. So we can use the genetic differences between bacteria infecting different people to trace transmission, which is another way of trying to understand transmission of tuberculosis. Instead of asking people, instead of doing contact tracing, we go for the genome. From the bacteria. We ask the bacterial genome, how transmission is happening. And now we have these possibilities very similar to what we have been witnessing almost in real time for COVID, for SARS-CoV-2, in which we have this possibility because we have sequencing capacities, next generation sequencing that allow us to sequence hundreds of thousands of cases or isolates of the bacteria. We can now compare that because we have computer power for that, and we can transform genetic distances in transmission patterns. So we can understand now transmission at a level that was not possible before. We can understand transmission between continents, between countries, within a country, within a city, within between two persons. And that was not possible before, because before we have a lens that was very low resolution. So we have to put everything in one pot, but now we can start to disaggregate that pot. And this is allowing us to understand tuberculosis transmission at a resolution, a scale that was not even possible before. And now we are starting to understand things that we had no answer in, 5-10 years ago.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, again and again in these podcasts, what I'm coming across is the speed at which technology is moving and how that really opens up so many new horizons, also cheaper, faster, all of it. So how does this actually benefit healthcare providers, Iñaki? Are you at the stage already where you're communicating information to healthcare providers regarding an outbreak, rather like we were doing with PCR tests during the coronavirus crisis, or how's this working for you in practice?
Yes, so we are whole genome sequencing. This is more than a PCR, and that's why it's a little bit difficult. You have to think that in March 2020, it was not obvious that sequencing the whole genome of hundreds of millions of genomes of SARS-CoV-2 will help in any way. And now it's very clear that it helps, and it has been integrated in health systems, and every country that tried to control their epidemic, they have some kind of genomic surveillance system, and it's the same for tuberculosis. So now we go, it's more complicated, and that's why it's more difficult to integrate in the health system, because these are not routine processes. PCR was already there in some way or another in the hospitals, but the whole genome sequencing is not, instead in some countries like UK. And now yes, one of our objectives in the places we work, and particularly here in Valencia, for example, is that we can integrate the genomic information we get in the health system and help in different ways, both for the diagnosis of the bacteria and drug resistance. This is for the hospitals, but also for the public health offices, we help in two different ways. One is ongoing investigation of outbreaks, so something that is going on, so we try to help there and to try to clarify or complement what they are doing. And then the other part is evaluating the program, the tuberculosis control program. How much transmission are you cutting? Are you able to halt? How much transmission is going on? And is whether this transmission dynamics is the same in here in Valencia, is the same in Mozambique, or is the same in UK? These kind of things, we can now do that.
So you can actually see the impact of best practices. So if somebody is doing something and you can see clearly that the transmission is really, really greatly reducing, then you can apply whatever they're doing elsewhere and hope that the same thing will have the same result. Yeah, fascinating. So are you finding that healthcare professionals are embracing this? And another thing, actually, I also wanted to ask you is about antibiotic resistance. So two questions there. Is this something that's being embraced? You mentioned it's a bit tricky to do because it's not standard procedure, but are people trying to do it? And does it reveal anything about antibiotic resistant strains?
So probably there is one single answer to both questions. They are clearly convinced this is the way to move forward. Of course, the healthcare system, public healthcare system, move a little bit less slowly than other health systems and other stakeholders, because it's not that easy to integrate these new procedures. But they really see which are the advantages. And now we have an additional advantage, that is the coronavirus pandemic. One of the few good things we have after the coronavirus pandemic or after 2 years of pandemic is that it has been integrated for coronavirus in the health system finally. And this has opened the door to many other infectious diseases that were waiting behind. There was no funding or no priority, at least, to integrate. So now it's being embraced much more. And also because we have shown during the last 5 years a proof that they can help a lot. So we have helped here to diagnose multidrug resistant cases in Valencia. And we have helped here to complement their test in the hospital with our test with genomic information. And this has allowed to personalize treatments. So again, and related with what has been explained here, there is a lot of room in tuberculosis, in different aspects of tuberculosis, for personalized treatment, for personalized identification of TB cases, et cetera, that will allow, hopefully, to implement much better ways to control the disease.
Okay, fantastic. And what's the one finding from your project that you think actually will have the biggest impact in how outbreaks are controlled?
So I think because we are looking at transmission, as I said before, with a resolution was not able before, we can ask questions that we were not able to do like 5 years ago. And one of these questions is, there is this dogma that tuberculosis always transmits with symptoms, and we come back to latency again, which is a topic, as you have seen, that is very, very, very hot topic for tuberculosis. And this dogma says, okay, it's kind of you go to the hospital, you have symptoms, they screen, and they say, okay, you have tuberculosis, you are isolated. But then it turned out that by genomic sequencing, we can now tell when one person has infected to another person in retrospective. So when we started to do that, we realized that there were people in the community that were transmitting tuberculosis before having symptoms. So this is kind of asymptomatic, probably subclinical tuberculosis or incipient tuberculosis. That's not 100% clear, but clearly asymptomatic people, much in the way coronavirus transmits also. So the major problem with coronavirus control is really asymptomatic transmission or presymptomatic transmission. So that's why it's so difficult to control, and that's why we had to go to lockdowns. So it's the same for tuberculosis. It looks like there is a percentage of cases of transmission that are due to asymptomatic people, which what we don't know right now is which is the contribution to the global burden, which is the contribution to the number of cases we see every year. And this is something we are investigating, we and others, of course, are investigating right now. So how important is to incorporate asymptomatic transmission in our TB control programs, because our TB control programs are still based on the dogma active tuberculosis, symptoms, transmission. And this dogma is starting, as you see, to have leaks. So we are trying to understand.
Yeah, to be undermined. Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic that you can, obviously, it's absolutely fantastic that you can identify that, and that perhaps systems will have to adapt accordingly. But at the same time, it must have been bad news when you discovered it. I mean,
yes, but also, if you find something new, or you understand something that was not known before, and you know that tuberculosis epidemic is evolving very slowly. The way we control, the number of cases are being reduced only up to 2% incidence per year, not even that with COVID, then you really now you need to implement new ways of controlling tuberculosis. So it's not bad to know. What we need now is to implement ways to tackle this.
Yeah, and to actually use this new information.
Yes.
No, indeed. Thank you very much. Anyone got any questions for Iñaki? Yes, Hossam.
Please tell about the relation on the transmission of the TB for people with HIV or people with COVID-19 as well.
So for we have a lot more information for HIV than for COVID. And that's expected because COVID more recently than TB also has these latency periods that also takes more time to evaluate everything, no? Transmission and many other aspects. For HIV, originally it was proven that people with HIV tend to transmit less tuberculosis because they tend to have extrapulmonary tuberculosis. They don't tend to generate the typical lesion in the lung called cavitation, and cavitation we know is very tightly associated to transmission. But now, because we have all these improvements in HIV treatment, many persons living with HIV are now looking like healthier. So they are kind of catching up in this time. So they are starting to look like much more like a person without HIV, and therefore we can see a lot of transmission. Of course, in countries where there is a high burden of HIV, like South Africa, like Mozambique, where the HIV-TB is a syndemic, there we see a lot of transmission irrespective of HIV, but also in part because treatments are kind of catching up with that. Yeah.
Thank you, Iñaki. Any other questions? Teresa, would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, it's more
an observation.
Yeah, an observation or a thought that I have, and to know your opinion. So obviously we know that next generation sequencing has been a key in order to know more about transmission and epidemiology of tuberculosis and of the bacteria. So do you think we have reached a point where we have, let's say, extract as much information as we can from this technique? Or you think with further developments of next-generation sequencing, we can still go further in understanding and tackling tuberculosis? Or we are at a point where we need to, for example, to combine with artificial intelligence, as Hossam is doing, or we have just reached the top of how much we can get from next-generation sequencing?
That's a lovely question, Teresa. Thank you. So there's Iannaki. Have we got as far as we can get?
I don't know.
Well, your crystal ball. You need your crystal ball.
No, but the first thing is that when we are screening, we talk about a lot about whole genome sequencing, and the reality is that right now the typical technique we use for whole genome sequencing only allows to screen around 90% of the tuberculosis genome. That means there is a 5% of black matter which we are not screening and may hold secrets, to say so, both for transmission or for drug resistance, which we don't know. This can be solved. There are now sequencing technologies that allow us to cover the whole genome now, yes, and go for the 100% or 99%. And this will be developments in the future for sure, to understand what is in this part of the genome that may help to increase resolution even more than we have right now. Of course, there are many other developments in parallel that are important in TB genomics, like artificial intelligence, particularly for drug resistance, has been applied a lot. The people that is working in TB genomics and is trying in terms of drug resistance is to identify all the mutations in the genome of Mycobacterium tuberculosis that make it resistant to an antibiotic. And this looks like simple because if you talk with people that is not coming from Mycobacterium tuberculosis, will say yes, because tuberculosis is kind of a low diversity pathogen. It should be simple. It's not. It turned out that we are still missing a fair percentage of mutations that we don't know where they rely, and we can not use for diagnosis because we don't know which mutations are. And artificial intelligence is being used in that direction also to try to predict where in the genome of the bacteria we need to look at to predict drug resistance. So yes, there are many developments in terms of technology that can still be applied.
Not anywhere near out of work yet.
Not yet.
No, not yet. Not for a while.
I mean, if you work on tuberculosis, probably the only thing that can shorten our task is a protective vaccine. And this is something we are not expecting in the near future, probably in 10 years, 15 years, not even with messenger RNA vaccines, because TB is more complicated than SARS-CoV-2. Yeah.
Ah, fascinating. Yeah, that's a pity. So I'm glad you mentioned vaccines. I hadn't thought of that at all. So that's a really good place to end on, and I really appreciate that. I want to thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I particularly enjoyed the way that you chatted amongst each other as well. Thank you for that. It was always interesting listening to you guys talking together. It always throws up more interesting points. Superb. Thanks very much to you, all of you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All the very best.
Bye.
Are you interested in what other EU-funded projects are doing to understand how TB infects us, resists drugs, and switches from one state to another? The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 programme that are working in this area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains and subjects, from giant fossilised dormice to giant planets. There's something there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.